What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. GenTech is the always wired generation. Technology is so integrated into teens' lives that it's difficult to measure where their offline life begins and their online life ends. According to a CBS News poll, teens spend, on the average, 3 hours a day in the Internet. Their daily routine includes cell phone, text, instant message, Facebook, and MySpace. This social change has profound impact on family dynamics, interpersonal relationships, education, crime, and even the way major companies conduct business. Teens are different from their parents. Their relationship to information and media is different, and they communicate in new and different ways. They learn differently. Often parents are out of touch, or maybe not as savvy as their teen children. Dr. Wes Crenshaw, author of Dear Dr. Wes, Real Life Advice for Parents of Teens, talks with 411 Teen about the challenges of parenting the GenTech generation. Dr. Wes Crenshaw, welcome to 411 Teen.
Nice to be back on, Liz.
Yeah, appreciate it. What are some of the particular challenges for parents of the GenTech generation?
Well, I think staying caught up is probably one of the hard parts. I'm a pretty good IT guy. I had my first computer in my sophomore year of college back in 1983, if you can imagine that. So I've kind of grown my whole adult life with technology, and I have a hard time keeping up with what the latest trends may be. And teenagers, of course, are very, very interested in that kind of novelty, and so they're always going to be ahead of their parents. I have a few of the Luddite teens I see that disavow these foolish instruments, but the majority of them are pretty excited about them, and so they're always going to be a step or two ahead of their parents.
Are there any suggestions that you may make that parents may do to address this attempt to stay caught up?
Well, I think that's always a little bit more difficult than what I think is the simpler alternative, and that is you always need to kind of think with every box that comes in the house with a cool gadget in it, always assume that there's one manual that's missing in the box. You know, there are coupons and there's lots of little cute things about how to clean it and how to program it and so on. But what's missing in there is the ethics manual for how you should use it. And every technology that kids have today really needs to have an ethics manual. And since you can't figure that Apple and Sony and whoever are going to write it for you, you're going to have to do that yourself. And before kids power that thing up for the first time, you and the teenagers and preteens, of course, need to sit down and talk about what is the ethical usage of that device.
Okay. When we talk about teen tech, just what all devices are we including? I mean, cell phone, computers, what encompasses teen tech?
Well, you named a few of them. I suppose one that doesn't immediately pop to mind is digital cameras. Now, sure, those are built into a lot of phones now. In fact, I always say that telephones are really tiny television stations in your pocket.
They are.
Because you can broadcast about anything that way. But we see certainly the Kindles and the similar tablets, the iPads also in similar tablets, and phones, and then, of course, computers have multiple kinds of technology on them. And don't forget video games, because particularly for boys and for a lot of girls, they do consume a fair amount of time and are the center of some kids' lives. So those are the top ones we run into.
Okay, well, I want to explore some of those further. But when we look at technology and you kind of assess it, evaluate it, what do you think creates the biggest problem these days?
Well, I think think it's exactly that problem of the power of the technology flies faster in the world than the guardian angel of our ethics can keep up. And we, for example, and this is, I'm just going to go to the most problematic example I can think of, the whole sexting situation. We called this, you know, our books are based on newspaper columns that we've written since 2004, and we called this out on about the first day that a teenager was handed a phone with a camera on it, because it's problematic enough that kids write sexually explicit texts, and that has been true, you know, that's just an extension of how they talk, so it's not really that unusual. But when you start zipping pictures of your naked body all over the school or the county or the nation or the world, this is really a step up, and a lot of kids have actually not thought for a moment about the significance and the ramifications of that before they do it. They think this is a one-to-one communication, like something they're doing privately, and you can imagine how quickly that goes awry.
Oh, yeah.
And there are just hundreds of those examples, that one being the worst, of ways that technology gets going past kids' thinking about the implications of what they're doing.
So we're back to talking about guidelines that parents need to set up, limiting the access, or do you agree that parents should limit their teens' access to, I guess, all of this technology or some of it? What's your position on that?
Well, it's funny that that's even a controversial position, and it certainly is for some people. Some people don't want to believe that that kind of limitation is in the purview of a parent, and it's strange to me because when you and I were kids, I bet your family had some kind of phone curfew that after a certain time at night, they didn't let calls come into the house, and we weren't allowed to make them. And it didn't, you know, we didn't like that. I don't recall thanking my parents for their, you know, their rules about that. I recall trying to thwart those rules quite a bit. And that's sort of what's different about being a teenager and being an adult. As a teenager, you're supposed to do teenager things, and one of them is try to stay on the phone longer than you're supposed to. And parents are supposed to do parent things, which is to limit that. And if you expand that a hundredfold to our modern world, I think that means that parents do have an obligation to be involved in how their kids use technology. Now, I know all the teenagers of northern Florida and southern Georgia will together at this moment scream in terror about this, because I've heard them do it in my office. Mm-hmm. But the upshot is Facebook is a super printing press. The Hearst Corporation, you remember newspapers back in the day, the Hearst Corporation would have given anything to have a printing press with the power every teenager has on Facebook. And we've talked about the little tiny TV station in your pocket. I do a lot of tweeting. People can follow me on Twitter and get lots of good advice about parenting teens. But that's like a tiny little radio station. You're sending information all over the world. And kids have a hard time really seeing how much power they have. And that parent's obligation is to help them understand that and to use it as wisely as is possible.
Dr. West, at what point would you recommend that we give kids a cell phone? Because I'm thinking of, I know of kids who are in the grade school population who have phones.
Absolutely true. And I think that one of the things you're going to see as we talk about this is every one of these technologies, it's sort of like in Star Wars where you have the dark side and the light side. It's the perfect double-edged sword where you've got good things that are just amazing. I mean, it's just amazing that I have interactions on Twitter with young people and parents all over the world. I have a very favorite teenager I follow in Toronto. I just always think she has smart, sharp-edged little things to say, and I like to retweet her. And that's amazing to me that we can have that kind of a dialogue out there and get to know each other and know a little about each other's lives. And parents can benefit by following teens on Twitter. Not, you know, I don't just mean their kid, but kids all around the world, to find out what teens are doing. But there's the dark side to that, in that people fight on Twitter. I cannot understand why people get on there and publish their quarrels all over the world. They put pictures up right there, just like everywhere, every other media that they shouldn't. And so, you know, everything has a really dark side and a light side to it in these technology worlds. And parents have to try to help kids figure out how much light side they can use and as little dark side as possible.
Well, what conditions would you identify that would determine when a child can be given a cell phone?
Well, I think, I'm sorry, you asked that, and I went to the large answer and forgot the small.
That's all right.
Partly is because I resist the I resist math questions on the test. I think you know, age isn't as important as the need, and one of the light sides, one of the good sides of the force, is that you can talk to your kid pretty much whenever you need to by text or by phone. And if you have latchkey kids, or if you have kids that are in after school program, or if you need to pick your kids up at soccer, that's pretty helpful. And honestly, it's a helpful tool for even late grade school kids, pre-middle school kids, to social network, particularly kids who are a little bit shy. You know, being able to use texting is a great boon for those kids. So the age is less important than it is to sit down and get them to understand the ethics manual. Gosh, if you ask my 8-year-old son what the first discussion we had was about his new digital camera, he will tell you, you're not allowed to take pictures of people's body parts under their clothes. He will tell you that because we've had that discussion. And some he doesn't know why that's an important issue. One of these days, when that great idea comes into his head, when he's 12 years old, he will remember we had that discussion and hopefully think about it.
As we look at this technology and how it advanced, what we're talking about really is kids, teens, always being in touch, so to speak.
Correct.
Communications never ending. What impact does this have really on our communication style, though?
Well, it's very interesting because if we took your sentence and made no inflection in it at all, it would say communication that's never ending. And that sounds very beautiful. I mean, here, you know, communication, wow, you know, reach out and touch someone. And that is, it is. That's the light side. That's the good side of the force here. And the dark side is that, frankly, when you make it possible, particularly for teenage girls who comprise the majority of my caseload, when you make it possible for kids who are built to be very social and very talkative and very interfaced with their peers, and you give them a device that lets them do that 24/7, guess what they're going to do?
They're
going to be on there
24/7.
That's right. And so we've really hyped up something that I think is neat. I think it's fascinating how girls interact with each other. Sometimes it's not pretty, and other times I think it's just lovely. But now we've given them a super drive for that by phones and Facebook and so on. And it's I think it's actually adding substantially to kids' anxiety to be on that much. Kids sleep with those cell phones, which I, by the way, strongly recommend against.
Well, you talk about that the new tech bedroom looking like Mission Control, and indeed it does. But you advise against that. Would you share with our listening audience, parents, why you advise that bedroom looking like Mission Control?
Well, you know, there are a lot of things in psychology that we can say are kind of relative to people's cultures, to people's socioeconomic group, to how they were raised, and so on. And this just ain't on that list. This is just bad. It's never a good thing to have your bedroom, your child's bedroom, or anyone else's bedroom, wired, like she said, like Mission Control. We talk about that in the books. And the reason for this is very simply sleep research. We know that if people are overstimulated in the hour before they're supposed to sleep, the quality of their sleep and their ability to get to sleep will really be impaired. And teenagers are typically not going to turn off the electronics until they absolutely have to, and it's pretty easy to get back on them. And the bedroom, the first thing we do with people who have sleep disorders, young or old, is get them to make their bedroom into something that they associate with sleep. And there's just mm-hmm. no way that playing Call of Duty is going to be associated with sleep, or Facebook, or Farmville, or Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I have trained myself. I always think it's fun to get on and see what Twitter's been doing. And I'll give myself about 20 minutes of that, and then I force myself to plug the phone in and go into my pre-rest time. So I know why kids don't want to do it. It's not very interesting to give up your electronics and lay there and plan to go to sleep. But that is what we recommend, and bedrooms are not really a good place for that, not to mention the fact that that also makes the supervision of usage much more difficult.
That indeed is the case. I'm reminded of a client I had, and in talking with his mom, she would say how she would tell him to go to his room when his behavior was inappropriate. And he indeed was glad to go to his room. In fact, would engage in behavior to be sent to his room because his room had everything in it. And
yes, she
didn't
might as
take
well
it.
Have sent him to an arcade.
Right, right. Exactly. His room had everything in it, and he was not the least bit upset by being sent to his room. So that's another little sidebar there when we talk about this room, you know, sending kids to their room.
So true. And I think some parents have arranged it the way you're describing it,
mm-hmm.
so that rather than putting the kid in time out, they're sort of giving themselves time out,
mm-hmm.
so they don't have to be in a parenting role. And I hate to sound kind of jaded, but when we were younger, this was what the television
used that's to right
doing.
That's
exactly
right.
And now you can babysit your kids all day long on mm-hmm. video games. So it's one needs to be cautious about how even adults are interacting with technology.
I've been talking with Dr. West, author, parent, psychotherapist, advisor. Dr. West shares expert advice in family relationships and communication required for establishing and maintaining positive relationships with your children. We'll talk more after the break. Dr. West is an expert in family relationships and communication. He has worked with couples and families over 19 years, and for the last 8 years, he has co-authored the Double Take Advice column for teenagers and their parents in the Lawrence Journal. Dr. West, we talked about that bedroom being, you know, that mission control room. As you think about the technology and how it has advanced the world, do you feel like kids are growing too fast? I mean, they're overexposed to sex. There's growing disrespect for life. They know there's disrespect for privacy. Or am I just old school? that's what it seems like.
I think you're again speaking of what are our ethical views and obligations, and those never mm-hmm. should go out of our minds
vote.
Or
okay.
to be considered old school. But the way they are challenged or enacted nowadays, I think, is very new. Now, I think we were well on the path to a much more sexualized culture before mm-hmm. the Internet came along, but most assuredly, the Internet has made the clicks of a mouse and all your dreams come true. And parents have to be this creates, I've done a lot of talks lately in schools and actually visited a lot with kids. I was just out in doing a high school career day yesterday. And I think we have to realize there's a certain dualism here that unless you're going to literally turn the internet off and homeschool your kids and never let them out of the house, which some people elect to do, your kids are going to be exposed to objectionable content. There's just too many points of access in our society. Some parents make the mistake of throwing up their hands and saying, well, there's just nothing I can do. And that misses a crucial point. If you are putting up the filters in your home, if you're preventing that material from being accessed in your home, it doesn't matter as much that your kid sneaks down to Johnny's and looks at it. It matters that you're making the statement in your home about what you believe is
indeed
right. And that's what we have to do, just like we would with anything else. It's the statement
exactly
that's more important.
Well, I'm so glad you made that, because I've heard parents say, well, what's the use? Why should I try? I mean, he can still have access to it. But I think that, like you said, you're sending a message. You're putting a statement out there. And that is important, regardless if they do go someplace else. I mean, you can't control them 24/7.
Right. And you can have a dialogue about why you're filtering that material and expect them to hear what you're saying. If you believe that pornography is demeaning to women, or if you believe that it over-sexualizes kids when they're too young, those are fine things to tell your child in the discussion about online content. And, you know, the other thing that's almost more, that's pretty important stuff, but the thing that's almost more important is the kind of things kids are putting out onto the internet, not just what they're seeing, and having a really strong discussion about that. When I was talking to the career kids yesterday, I asked them, what's the point of Facebook? We were talking about marketing as part of the business. And, you know, they said, well, to network, to get information out. And I said, that's exactly right. And right this minute, you need to be pretty clear on what you want to put out there. Mm-hmm. Because I guarantee your college in a couple of years, and your job a few years after that's going to stalk your Facebook like nobody else.
That's right.
And they looked a little surprised, but not only for a moment, as they thought it through.
Mm-hmm. Well, often Facebook postings are, you know, they try to keep them away from parents. And what's your what's your position on that? How do you feel about them having this? I mean, I know what you're going to say, but, you know.
Well, it's funny because you and I know what I'm going to say, and you would be just astounded at the looks I get from teenagers. And, you know, it's funny. I am not a very shy fellow, and I just tell kids, you don't have enough time in life to sit around and let me be subtle, so let's just get down to it. And kids respect that. And when I turn, when a kid says, well, I just want my Facebook to be private, are you insane? What planet do you live on? You know, if you don't want something, if you want something private, I will defend your right to have a secret diary under your bed to the death. I will tell the parent that is not yours to read unless you believe your child is at imminent risk. That's private. And the words Facebook and privacy should never even appear in the same sentence together. That's not what Facebook is about. I actually had a hilarious thing on Twitter one day. This kid from Minnesota, I think. I didn't actually become a follower of hers, but I was noticing a retweet she'd done. And she says, I hate it when teachers get on Twitter. And it's just like they're spying on me.
Oh.
And I thought, honey, you don't understand how this works at all. We're all supposed to be spying on
that's
you.
Right.
You want to put it out there.
That's right. Well, sexting involves sharing sexually explicit photos, videos, and chat electronically. It's really pretty common. A recent survey found that 20% of teens, that's 13 to 19, 33% of young adults, 20 to 26, had sent nude or semi-nude photographs of themselves. 30%, or I would think it was 39%, and 59% of young adults had sent sexually explicit text messages. Now, I know in some states, Florida, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, these young people have been charged with felonies for sending nude pictures.
Correct.
What's your position on that? How do you feel about that?
A
lot of them say, well, I didn't know.
I will sum this up by saying, what a giant mess. We have published multiple articles on this, and I do not, I am not a hysterical person. I am not a prude. If you're going to work with teenagers,
you can't be.
You well know, Liz, you have got to be pretty
right.
cool about stuff and chill. And this is one I am not chill about. About 3 or 4 years ago, the Centers for Missing and Exploited Children, which is, of course, a nationally respected operation for monitoring child sexual abuse, came out with a report that said the same thing we had said a year before in our column, mm-hmm. which is you don't really have very much to worry about with online predators. This is not really where the problem is. The problem is what kids themselves put out on the Internet mm-hmm. of their own free
Indeed.
Will. And exactly, and through their phones. And I could sit here and spend the next three shows just giving you one story after another mm-hmm. of how these things have gone awry. The upshot of it is that I do not like to see kids ever prosecuted for this sort of thing mm-hmm. because very, very, very rarely is there a victim and an offender. These are usually two people who are doing this absolutely consensually. Where the pressure has come into play on occasion is that this is done within a couple, as a dating couple.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then the breakup happens, and somebody
right.
doesn't want to give up the material. And I have had to have some pretty stern discussions with people about why that is especially wrong. In our articles, our first article 1 week said, don't ever do this. Do not do it. And the next week said, if you did it, here's what you have to do. And we went through the procedures to reset phones, to destroy video chips, to protect them if you're not going to destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you said statistically is absolutely true. To the extent that the college students, my college kids I see, when I survey them, I have the ability to like text out these things and get kind of survey people that know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell me it's so common to sext a partner
yeah.
with verbal text
yes.
that they will excuse themselves from their girlfriends for a few minutes to go get that done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, almost like they're going to go make out with somebody in the corner.
Exactly.
They go over and do the
yes.
sexting. And that part isn't as dangerous as the pictures. And it is very common for adults to be doing this now, which is legal. That's
yeah, it's legal.
But for minors, it isn't. And we really try to get kids not to do this. We understand most of the time this is not being done maliciously or
no.
with any
Mm-mm.
inappropriate intent. But it is a very bad idea, and it is child pornography, whether a you know, the neighborhood pervert or the girl herself or boy makes it. It is still child pornography, and we need kids to just not do that.
Well, and I thank you for sharing that, because I don't think that everyone is aware of just how it starts. And it does usually start with a romantic interest, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, and then it goes awry and something happens. So I appreciate you taking the time to share this. And I think you touched on something else that we've already mentioned, is that these young folks are just not aware of the consequences of their behavior in the future.
Right.
You know, when they get ready to apply for college, when they get ready to look for a job, they just don't understand how far reaching this behavior is and what impact it can have.
Well, and you of course, you as well as I know why that is, and that's mm-hmm. because brain development is just not there
They're
yet.
Not
and
there.
Kids, that's the neat thing about being a kid, is that you have, you know, greater carefreeness and greater ability to try new things and all that stuff. And that is the, you know, the good side of the force again. And the dark side is that you will do some things that are particularly problematic. Back mm-hmm. when you and I were kids, you know, the only recollection of the stupid things you and I did is in our heads, right?
Yeah.
And in our modern world, kids document their stupid things for everyone to see forever. And I try to be that blunt with kids. And it's very interesting. I hate to say this, but where the trend is, as far as I can tell, is that rather than saying, OMG, I've got to mm-hmm. stop doing that, they say, well, you've got a naked picture of me on your phone, and, you know, that's
mm-hmm.
not really yours. And
right.
that's the end of the discussion. I've seen it happen many times.
Yeah. And I also think just the impact that it may have on that teen who's teetering, who may be really very insecure, who's not comfortable with self, has some depression. I think of a teen in Cincinnati that reportedly committed suicide after her nude photo was sent all around school by her ex-boyfriend. And the parents, you know, felt like it was the photo that caused her suicide, when we know there's not any one thing, but it probably was the thing that just tipped her over the edge. What role does the possibility of causing personal humiliation play? I mean, where does it fit into the equation?
Yeah, that's such a good question, Liz. And I just, you know, I hate stories like that. If I were to tell you the long list of examples, I said two or three of them have involved interdicting that material and getting it out of circulation. And so trying to run that interference, you know, with the family and as the therapist, and sometimes just with the client, because the client doesn't want to know, doesn't want anyone to know that it's out there. And so trying to help her, and usually tends to be a girl, trying to help her take an action to interdict that. The thing I try to teach, and this kind of goes to the larger issue of bullying and what I call mean kid behavior, that is, you know, more in the media right now because of the movie and some other things that have gone on. There have been a couple of other deaths recently that appear to be related to bullying. And what I am telling people is that they need to really be thinking about how they're raising their kids. Now, I understand there's that unreachable group over there, the parents that are just not interested enough. And we talk too much about them and the bully kids they produce. And we don't talk enough about the, quote, good families and the bully kids, mean kids they produce. And amongst the families that say, you know, they're interested and don't want this to happen, I'm trying to teach them what I call the three E's, which is ethics, empathy, and excellence in behavior, and to hold kids tenaciously accountable for those three factors. So if your kid is out on the soccer field and knocks another kid down and doesn't, you know, step over and put his hand down to help the kid up, you call him out on that later. Likewise, parents don't stand on the sidelines of a basketball game and scream insults and vulgarities at other players or the refs. It's not that important, and it's more important to teach kids ethical and empathic play. And people will say, oh, but, you know, that'll turn him into a big wuss. No, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot more guts to be the ethical person than it does to be the unethical one. Right. And that's where I would try to go to prevent somebody from letting their kid be the person who spread that picture around.
Well, you know, I had a parent, I just have to share this with you. I had a parent tell me, in reference to sexting, that it was just, how did they say it? It's just a high-tech way to flirt, and it really means nothing. You can look at pictures, you could look at Playboy, and so what's the difference?
Yeah, well, Playboy, that girl got paid a lot
to be in there.
And in the real world of sexting, the person's really, the benefit for that individual is pretty minimal, and the negatives are pretty huge. The part about the flirting, I don't totally disagree with that. And the thing I try to, kids are going to keep doing this, whether we like it or not, and I try to focus more on the language and what they are. And I don't mean the naughty language. I mean the way they're conveying themselves. So, and I got to tell you, texting has been an amazing resource in working in therapy with kids, because they not only will give me updates during the week, but they come in and read the texts to me that they've sent and others have sent to them, and we sort of critique that in a much tighter way than, and you know how people's memories are. So this is a much more accurate way of seeing what's being said. And so rather than say, why are you talking about sex on your phone with your boyfriend, we can actually say, you know, you're being really forward with somebody you don't know at all. This person's not really going to be interested in anything but a booty call. And that discussion is more valuable than saying don't talk about sex on the phone with a boy, because they're going to do that anyhow.
Right. Yeah, they most certainly are. And there's nothing you can do about that. But at least you can give them the guidelines, and you can also explain to them the consequences of this behavior. Maybe talk
and
about
do they want to make a transcript of this discussion? I always remind them of that.
It will follow you. That's something that I often emphasize, that, you know, it's not just said. It will follow you all over. It's not just one picture that you send to your friend. It's out there in cyberspace, and everyone gets to look at it.
Absolutely. And I do very clearly distinguish between talking sexy on texting and sending a nice picture of your butt. There's a big difference between those two, and one of those is never a good idea if you're a minor, even if you're it's your best boyfriend ever.
Right. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. This hour, I've been talking with Dr. West about the Gen Tech generation. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll return momentarily. What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and joining me is Dr. Wes Quinshaw. It's so nice. He's doing it twice. He's been here before, and we're always very pleased to have him return. We've been talking about the impact of technology on parenting and the development of young folks. Cyberbullying, digital bullying, and online bullying comes to mind. We were talking about that right before we went on break. Somebody writes something mean or a lie on the internet, and it goes from one person to another, instant messaging, taking pictures of someone in a sexual or compromised situation, and then sharing it with others. One thing we didn't address, and I wanted to ask you to address this for my listening audience, is how does cyberbullying differ from the traditional type of bullying?
Well, this is, of course, the big question as we're trying to rethink how we approach this. We just did an article about this a week or two ago in our column, and folks can find a link to that on my website, drwest.com. It's dr-west.com. And what the biggest difference, there are kind of two differences with cyberbullying. One of them is the power it has. It's not like you just stand in the hall with a couple of friends and put somebody down or push them or something. It's that you stand in front of the world and try to shame somebody, try to humiliate somebody. And you do that not face-to-face. That's the second point of it. It is, if not completely anonymous, and there are circumstances in which it is completely anonymous, but at least not in having to actually confront the person you're humiliating. And the cyberbullying thing, I cannot prove this, but I would argue that the cyberbullying situation has evolved from the general lack of social civility that we see in the media today, and the way that people are paid a lot of money to say really vulgar and hateful things about other people in our society, political leaders or financiers or people of different persuasions, and this is reinforced now. And if you say, you know, that's really wrong to speak of a people that way, someone jumps up and screams political correctness like that's a curse. And I think young people cannot, we cannot expect young people to do better at anything than adults do. They're going to see our example.
Oh, yeah.
And cyberbullying is really an extension, I think, of that non-face-to-face hide in a corner and call out nasty names to somebody behavior we see at a national level, and kids really have picked up on it.
Okay. You know, discipline is often a moot area, whether it's on with technical devices or not, it's a moot area for parents. And I always get questions, talk about discipline, talk about discipline. So before we run out of time, I'm going to jettison over to discipline. What suggestions can you provide for parents concerning the discipline of their teen children?
The first thing I suggest is people start by using the word as a noun, meaning you think, what is my discipline? What do I believe? What are my values? And then realize that as parents, your job is to convey those values, and kids' job is to try to be different. And this cannot be a seamless, easy process. And a lot of parents want it to be. It's very painful for them to have to enact that discipline with rules and guidelines. And one must really get their head right around that and understand their job is different. Now, some people simplistically will say you can't be your kid's friend. You know, that's true. You're not here to just be their friend. But I think it's more important to think you have to be the authority, not the authoritarian, but the authoritative parent. And if you can get your head around that, then a lot of the specifics become easier to enact. And setting, being able to set consequences is just not that hard. There are a lot of good books about it, natural and logical consequences. It's getting the will to do that. And there's some things that are inconvenient, like if your child is having trouble with drugs or alcohol, parents need to just jettison that from their lives. It's not helpful saying you can't do these things, but we're going to sit around and do them too. Kids are going to have time with that. So finding your discipline, enacting it, realizing as the parent you are the primary influence over your kid, and then coming up with natural and logical consequences and following through.
Well, you were reading my mind because I was going to ask you about drugs and sex. Those are often issues that parents freeze on, you know, when you start talking about drugs and sex. How honest should parents be concerning their past behavior with about drugs? Because, you know, we have these parents who have experienced a number of different drugs, you know, the baby boomer parents, and you say, well, I can be very free and open with my child, and I can tell them everything. How honest do you think parents should be?
Part of finding your voice as a parent is realizing that it makes no difference what you did when you were 14. Yes. When you were 14 or 15, that was your parents' responsibility to parent you, and that's your responsibility now. And parents will get, they will think they're hypocrites if they tell their kid to do something.
Exactly.
And you're only a hypocrite if you're doing it now, if you're doing this bad decision now and tell your child not to do it. You're not going to have authority or the what we call referent power over your kid, the power of the child wanting to emulate you. And so you have a hard time with that. But whatever you did in the past, nobody cares about. And the kid will only take that and use it as a way to pop you over the head. So I suggest that memories are just stories we tell ourselves about things that happened in the past. And if you have a story, something you did and a consequence came to you and it was harmful, you can tell that story, but do not make it sound glorious. You know, when you say, oh, I was so drunk and you know, I fell down the stairs and my friends had to carry me home. And there's something in that story that sounds kind of neato.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That's not the story you want to be telling. And it's better if kids ask to say, it's just too horrible to think about, unless your story conveys the message you actually want to convey.
How do parents encourage sound decision making? Any suggestions that you may have there?
Isn't that a great question, Liz? You always have smart questions. You'd think that you talk to teenagers too, or something. the term I use is the same one is that some kids have better judgment than others. Mm-hmm. They're probably not trustworthy in the sense that they are where they say they are, doing what they say they're going to do, but some of them have better judgment. And parents can enhance that by giving kids choices early in life and helping them process which would be the best choice. My kid would buy everything in Walmart. He's very mm-hmm. certain he needs all of it. And I always sit there and go through this endless, boring process of saying, okay, now what will happen if you purchase this? You won't have enough money for the DS you want. How's that going to work for you? And we may sit there, and he gets upset with me and just on and on. And finally, of course, I have to say, well, you can go home and get your money. I'm not going to float you any money. You're going to home, get your money. You can come back here and hand it to the person. Well, by the time he actually has to go through that process, it has caught up with him that this wasn't that great an idea. So mm-hmm. sometimes slowing down the decisions, talking through them, and helping kids understand the rationale is very helpful. Some parents will say, well, you know, it's just because I said so. There's no learning in that. There's mm-hmm. no learning. The teachable moment is when you're able to explain your rationale for this and realize the kid isn't going to jump up and say, thanks, Dad. Wow, you have prevented me from making an unwise purchase. I feel so fortunate. They're not going to like that. But eventually they'll learn why and how you made your decisions, and they can eventually emulate that.
Talking about teachable moments, let's look at schools. And what role or what can schools do to promote good online information consumption and conduct? Mm-hmm. Do you think they have a role in that at all?
A critical role, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of argument right now about whether schools can how well they can intercede in online bullying and cyberbullying, and I understand why that's a debate. But what's not debatable is that they are teaching kids a lot of information consumption and management tasks in school, and that whole idea of having an ethical approach to it is critically important. The other thing you mentioned that's right on the money is that there's enough information on the internet to keep us busy for the next 30 decades or centuries, and kids are not as necessarily ready to distinguish critically between good quality information sources and poor information sources. Frankly, adults are having a hard time with that. So schools very much have to teach critical thinking skills on the internet to help kids know how to decipher sources as our world becomes more and more complicated that way. But yes, schools have a big role in that. I think some schools are doing an amazing job and other schools haven't quite gotten the memo. It's good for parents to check that out and find out.
Earlier mentioned video games and how tremendously popular they were. Video games, are they really addictive?
Absolutely. Now, you have to understand the difference between a behavioral addiction and a physical
mm-hmm.
addiction.
Okay. And share that with us.
Well, yeah, that's what it comes down to because, for example, cocaine is physically addictive. Mm-hmm. The reason marijuana is that it's not physically addictive, but I can promise you there are a number of people I work with that have behavioral addictions to marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, I have worked with people who have behavioral addictions to video games. The most popular, well, it may not be the right term, the most common to addict people is World of Warcraft. The way it is designed makes it very, very interesting and pleasurable to play. Oh. And anytime you have things that are super interesting and super pleasurable, that's where you have the potential for addiction. Very few people get addicted to reading Moby Dick. It's just there's a tiny number of them. That's not too common. It has to be something that's super interesting and pleasurable. Mm-hmm. And that gives the brain what it likes, and it's going to keep seeking that. And games like World of Warcraft and to some degree, Halo and mm-hmm. Call of Duty and the others, that they're really designed well to integrate with other people around the world. So you're really working in kind of a group problem-solving fashion as well as having the exciting moments happening to you. And so, yes, that builds up a reaction in the brain that some people have a difficult time just turning off and being able to go on to other things. And as you know, the two factors in an addiction are that you keep doing it despite negative consequences, mm-hmm. and that you cannot stop yourself. And so that's all it takes. And there are actual treatment programs now for people who are addicted to video games and all sorts of online behavior.
If a parent feels like their child is addicted, they're caught up, they're online all the time, what should you do?
I would definitely, and again, I like to be careful because addiction is one of those things you don't want to hurl around too freely. But if it meets those criteria and the kid, and usually parents can figure that out, there are specialists now. We have them here in our university town who specifically work with behavioral addictions as well as others. And I would use an addiction model. It's a little bit less of a therapy model than it is an addiction model. And I think we're going to have to face up to that. I have adults. I have adults in their 30s who are having withdrawal from having to get out of the video game world. And they have spouses who are demanding they do it because they don't see anything of them.
Mm-hmm. It's always a pleasure. The information you share with my listening audience is invaluable. Would you share your website again for them?
Sure. I would be happy to. It is drwes.com, which is dr-wes.com. If you forget the hyphen, you will instead learn a lot about a high-fiber diet, which is great, okay. but has nothing to do with me. So, we have all of the links for different ways you can buy the books. They're on, and I think we mentioned that there's also a book for teens that is exactly similar in content but different columns. And both books are available on Amazon. They're available on both Kindle and Nook and paperbacks. And we are happy for families to have them, and it should give you plenty to discuss in your family table.
Well, and I'll have to get you back again. I mean, I enjoy talking to you, and again, your information is so full. So maybe in the fall, if you don't mind, I'll give you a call.
I will always be on your show, Liz. This is always so fun to talk to you because we have such a lot of interesting things to discuss about a topic we're both interested in.
Well, thanks so much to my listening audience. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. This edition of 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical engineer, Evan Rossi. Audio copies are available, and if you would like to participate in 411 Team or have topic suggestions, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. That's 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Team Podcast, log in wfsu.org.